Hello and welcome to The Late Debate with me, Audrey Carvel. Coming up on the programme tonight, can Northern Ireland have peace and justice?
I didn't ever believe it would work for everybody. In fact, I fully respected some families who just didn't want the police to look into their case. They wanted someone else. Well, that was fine. The problem was there was nothing else.
Resolving a violent and murderous past. Our late debate tonight, after the news. It's read now by Angus McGreena.
Good evening. Opposition parties have described the government's plan for water charges and allowances as window dressing. The Cabinet decided that the average charge will be €240 a year, and this will be fixed until 2016. There will be no standing charge. There will be an allowance of 30,000 litres per household per year and a further allowance for children. Charges will be capped for people with certain medical conditions, and there will be a €100 allowance for carers, pensioners and people with disabilities. Irish Water has welcomed the announcement. A company spokeswoman, Elizabeth Arnott, said the Commission for Energy Regulation would make a final decision on the level of water charges in August.
The regulator now has to undertake their work. They're running a consultation at the moment in terms of defining what the tariff structure will be, and they will also run consultations in the summer and will determine fully what the tariff structure and the cost of water will be by August of this year. However, the CEO or the regulator couldn't undertake their work until the government had made the announcements that they've made today.
A Spanish student who was hit by a bus in Bray in County Wicklow 5 years ago has settled his High Court action for €9 million in damages. Carlos Tesh from Madrid was 12 years old when he suffered head injuries. The court heard he is dependent on others in every aspect of his life. The United States is to deploy security personnel and assets to help in the search for more than 230 schoolgirls abducted in Nigeria. They were kidnapped by the Islamist militant group Boko Haram last month. Police said that another 8 girls were taken from a village in northeastern Nigeria overnight. New York's planning authorities have granted permission to a development company controlled by Sean Dunn's son, John, to build a luxury apartment block. The firm, TJD21, plans to build the 6-storey building in the historic cast iron district in Soho. The apartment block is expected to generate a profit of $3 million for the company. Sean Dunn has admitted involvement in the project and his wife Gail has an ownership interest. And the weather forecast, showers for much of the night, but they will become isolated in the east. Lowest temperatures 6 to 9 degrees. Sunny spells and occasional showers tomorrow, some of them heavy. That's all for now. We'll have news again at 11.
Angus, thank you very much indeed. You're very welcome back to The Late Debate. With me in studio tonight, our solicitor Michael Finucane, whose father Pat Finucane was murdered by loyalist paramilitaries in 1989. A number of inquiries concluded that state forces had colluded with the gunmen. In the BBC studio in Belfast, we're joined by Jude White, whose mother Peggy White was murdered in a UVF bomb attack in 1984. We're also joined from there by Sinn Féin MLA Alec Maskey. He was interned twice in the 1970s on suspicion of IRA offences. And from London, we're joined by DUP MP Geoffrey Donaldson. Two of his cousins, Sam Donaldson and Alex Donaldson, both RUC men, were murdered by the IRA in 1970 and in 1985. You're all very welcome indeed. We're debating tonight if Northern Ireland can achieve both peace and justice. The question has been thrown into sharp focus in recent days following the arrest and release of the Sinn Féin president and TD for Louth, Gerry Adams, in connection with the death of Jean McConville 42 years ago. He denies any involvement. Under the Belfast Agreement, signed in 1998, paramilitary prisoners were released, and it was agreed that anyone convicted of an offence committed before that year would serve just 2 years in jail. But with so much time having passed, the gathering of evidence for a prosecution is surely close to impossible. So what are the families of those murdered, what are the maimed, to do? Are they expected to sacrifice justice for a peaceful Northern Ireland? It's a question, I suppose, that has been posed since 1998. And Jude White, if I could start with you. Jude, just tell us about what happened to your mother. Was she targeted by the UVF in that bomb attack?
Yeah, the bomb attack on our house was the third attack from 1982, 83 and 84. The first bomb, the bomber blew himself, blew his arm, his leg and half of his face off. He was a young fella from the Donegal Road, and the night of the bomb I was in the house. My mother asked me to go out and put a blanket and a pillow under his head, which I did. in some respects, looking back on it, it was probably an investment. Maybe they wouldn't come back and do it again, but they did come back on April 12th and put another bomb at the house, which killed my mother, who was a 53-year-old grandmother, and a young fellow from Braniel called Michael Dawson, a policeman, Constable Michael Dawson. He was 23 years of age. So it was a very specific targeting of my family. It certainly wasn't anything random. And it came after years of threats, abuse and degradation from elements in the security forces.
And why was that? Do you know why you were targeted like that?
One of the most, if you don't mind me saying, naive questions often the presenters asked you, and at the same time infuriating questions, and I'm not saying you're either naive or you're infuriating me, please forgive me and understand the context, is people like me are often asked this question, why you? And I mean, really what it suggests to me is that research into the conflict in this part of Ireland has never, ever been a top priority. There are 1,283 Catholic civilians killed in this conflict. And you could ask any one of their families the very, very same question. Why you? And there's a multitude of reasons. First of all, you are Catholic. Secondly, you live in a peripheral area. Thirdly, you're perceived to be something that perhaps you're not. And fourthly, it's opportunistic on behalf of loyalist paramilitaries who often went for the softest targets in peripheral areas. So there's one of four reasons, but certainly when I met David Irvine, who was a spokesperson for the UVF and did some work with him in the college that I work in, I asked him what was the specific logic of targeting civilian Catholics. And he was very, very frank, candid and honest, as he is. He said the purpose of targeting Catholics was to bring pressure on the IRA to call a ceasefire. Now, I found that a very naive analysis, but certainly in the 70s, that would have been a very naive analysis. But as time went on, there was a perception that Catholics would be Catholics, but certainly Catholics living in peripheral areas, unarmed Catholics, civilians, easy targets effectively, would be targeted in response to any operations that the IRA were carrying out. But, I mean, it's probably impossible for me to give you a justification. In the case of my mother, for example, my mother was a member of the Alliance Party and my father was the election agent for Basil Glass and David Cook. And just for the benefit of your listeners, they are a middle-of-the-road small unionist party up here. And there was nobody in my home ever arrested. We are a very strong Irish family. We are a Hurland family. We're into water polo. But, I mean, outside of those obvious indices of Irishism or Catholicism, I could see, I mean, there was no other reason whatsoever.
Was anyone convicted of your mother's murder?
No, there wasn't anybody convicted. And indeed, for 26, 27 years, any liaison that I had with the police service or any liaison that I had with even things like the Public Records Office, I found information very, very difficult to get. Two of my family have engaged the Historical Inquiries team now over 2 years, and they feel that they are getting very, very little real feedback into what this was about. But you don't have to have a brain like Einstein to understand the context. This was a large Catholic family living in a peripheral area, and simply our face didn't fit. And the purpose of this bomb was to intimidate the broad nationalist community of Belfast, in particular people who were living in peripheral areas. And for the benefit of your listeners, the Orme Road is a very, very small area of about 2,000 people. And in those days, it was nowhere near the main centres of the nationalist population in this city, north and west Belfast. So I suspect it was opportunism at its best, or at its worst indeed in this case.
And if now the police were to arrest someone and the prosecution service was to put them on trial for your mother's murder, would you welcome that?
I personally wouldn't welcome it because, I mean, I am on record and I'll repeat it tonight. I have no wish for whoever did this to be arrested or to go to jail ever. Indeed, if I knew who it was, I wouldn't tell the police. And that's not, I mean, those are for two very pragmatic reasons. I understand the context of why a young person would actually join an organisation like the UVF and the UDA in the 70s and 80s, and I would understand the poison that they had digested in being reared in this town from unionist politicians who actually were far, far more accountable, in my view, with their words and exhorting young people to violence. At a recent memorial on the Armour Road there, just on Saturday, we unveiled a plaque for in memory of six Catholic civilians who were murdered in a bar on the Armour Road, the Rose and Crown Bar. And I think you'll agree, the Rose and Crown, hardly an Irish-named bar. The person who actually did that was 15 years and 4 months when they threw a bomb through the front window of a bar. And at 15 years and 4 months, they had murdered six people. Now, to put that into context for your listeners, that's like somebody who is doing their junior cert in the South, somebody who's about third or fourth year in school. And this young man, when he was caught 3 years later, was at university doing a degree in architecture, and he went to jail for 14 years. And in one of his interviews when he got out, he said he had absolutely no idea what he was doing. He couldn't vote. He couldn't go into a bar. He couldn't look at an X-rated movie. He was simply a child. And sadly, there are many people, certainly from the loyalist perspective and the unionist perspective then and even contemporaneously, who are standing with flags and being exerted and exhorted on by people really who should know better. So I have no interest whatsoever in anybody going to jail.
But do you not want justice for your mother, whether it's through the person who actually planted the bomb or the person who gave the order for it?
Well, the person who planted the bomb is probably at the lower end of the food chain. The person who ordered it is probably one notch up. I would like some explanation, I think, from the dangerous, ill-informed, intemperate and some nasty politicians in the late 70s and early 80s who were saying and doing things that could have inflamed this situation. But I am a pragmatist. I know that I will never get real justice, and real justice is not an apology from some young fella from Sandy Row or the Shankill or the Donegal Road who listened attentively to politicians. I'd hardly get an apology from those politicians, and I certainly am not going to displace the blame for that action onto some young fella who's now in his mid-50s or 60s. I do not want to drag them away from their home or from their family in any way. I forgive them and I want them to get on with their life.
But has it taken you some time to get to that point? Because presumably after your mother was murdered, the grief and the shock and everything of that was horrific. And was there not a time where you wanted revenge?
I can never remember wanting revenge per se. My politics are red as opposed to green. And I often saw, and I still do see, that as communities up here, we have far more in common at times than divide us. We're certainly united by unemployment and sectarianism. We're united by a drug culture. We're united by rising house prices and landlordism. So, no, I never felt that sense of revenge. I felt an overwhelming sense of sadness, an overwhelming sense of nearly being politically lost. But I can't explain it. Maybe it was the way my mother and father reared us. The only time I can remember my mum and dad actually ever getting angry was when anybody made a sectarian comment in the house when the news was on. And this, I suppose, is the basis of what your programme is tonight. Can peace and justice actually go hand in hand? If justice is putting people in jail, I have no interest in it. And if justice is the price that we have to pay for peace, then I think people who have been bereaved, and I say this, and I'm choosing my words very, very carefully, I say this with sensitivity and I say this with respect. The contribution that victims can make to the last piece of the jigsaw here is enormous. And some of the most magnanimous people I come across are people who have suffered the most in terms of their lives being taken away, their limbs being taken away, being interned, being denied work, being denied jobs, etc., etc. There's no shortage of hate in this part of the world, and it's really time that Christians, and that's what effectively the North sees itself as, a very, very Christian society, it's time they come up to the mark and learn to forgive each other.
Michael Finucane, what's your definition of justice for your father?
I suppose my interest is in seeing the people who controlled the system that enabled the loyalists to carry out murders free from any fear of prosecution, apprehension, or incarceration. I don't think, like Jude, who's one of the few people I've heard talking about Northern Ireland in a long time, who's impressed me deeply, and I commend him for that. I think, like him, my perspective on the people who actually carry out the attacks and who carried out the attack on my father is much the same. They're very much at the bottom of the food chain. They were sacrificed like pawns in a chess game when the wider interests of the game required it or suited the people making the moves. And I suppose what, if anything, makes me angry, it's the fact that the state controlled this system, played this game with people's lives for such a long time, and now is continuing to play the game, but in a way that protects itself. I think many of the recent statements, many of the recent actions, and much of the recent inaction by certainly the British government is all designed to do one thing, and that's protect those elements within its own establishment who bear a huge amount of responsibility for the conflict in Ireland and the deaths that resulted from it.
Do you want prosecutions and convictions of those people at the very top?
No, I don't think prosecutions are the way forward for me. I think that prosecutions in the context of the conflict in Ireland are not the way forward, because a criminal prosecution is a very narrow exercise. It is a specific allegation framed in an indictment, supported by evidence that's controlled by tests of admissibility, and ultimately presented to a judge or a jury to examine and try a very specific question. And when you're dealing, I think, with post-conflict investigations, inquiries, or reviews, they are not amenable to those kind of very narrow, constrictive systems that are designed to protect the rights of the accused person and also serve the public interest.
So what for you, after 25 years, would lead you to say, I have got justice for my father?
Well, in my case, it's a public inquiry, a public forum where persons responsible for implementing and carrying out collusion processes with paramilitaries, loyalist and, it would appear, Republican as well, designed to manipulate the conflict and also designed to kill selected targets, my father, Pat Finucane, being one of them. I think those people being made to answer questions in a public forum where they can't hide, where they can't be shielded by persons in greater positions of authority, where they actually have to reveal what they knew, what they did, how they did it, why they did it, and for how long they were doing it. That, to me, is justice. And I think if you get that, that's my description of it. Other people's description may differ. But if you get justice, then you can have peace. It doesn't necessarily mean putting someone in a prison cell. Personally, I don't believe in prison as a policy of punishment in most scenarios anyway. I certainly don't believe in it to try and resolve the conflict that went on in Northern Ireland. But I do think if you can find a way of implementing justice, then you will have peace. I don't think getting a peace equals justice. And I don't think securing a peace or a political settlement will lead to justice. And I think the confusion between those two concepts has a lot to do with what is causing the problems at the moment.
And just before I bring in Geoffrey and Alec, in relation to the public inquiry that you want, do you want that specific for your father, or if it was a wider so-called Truth and Reconciliation Forum, bringing in the many, many victims of all violence, would that be sufficient or not? And everyone in there on an equal footing?
I think the issues raised by the murder of Pat Finucane, and I say this with a very personal connection to the case, obviously, but I think I'm objective enough to be able to assert the necessity for an inquiry in the case on its own merits. And the fact is, you have an officer of the court who was under threat for many years, not warned by the police that he was subject to that threat, not given any protection, not given any idea whatsoever that his life or his family's life was at risk, from a bunch of people who were resourced and controlled and permitted to carry out all sorts of unlawful activities, up to and including murder, by the state in all of its guises. I think that merits an inquiry by itself. I certainly think there is a strong case to be made for a wider process, but I think the level of disquiet that the Pat Finucane case and the system of collusion that case has led, has helped to reveal, needs to be examined in and of itself, because it is of such a huge level of concern to people nationally and internationally. It affects me, it affects my family, it was my dad, and I do have a personal interest. But I'm also a solicitor myself, and I think I can make an objective case for it. And I have heard many, many other people do the same. And I think it's a case that needs to be resolved, if for no other reason than the British government promised they would hold an inquiry. They promised it in five sample cases that were examined, six sample cases. And of all of those cases, the only one left unexamined by way of public inquiry is Pat Finucane. And I think the damage that that does to the reputation of the state, confidence in the rule of law, and the prospects of restoring full processes of law and order to Northern Ireland cannot be underestimated. And for all of those reasons, I would say a public inquiry in my dad's case is merited.
Geoffrey Donaldson. Geoffrey, you're joining us this evening from London, and you're very welcome. Did the families of your two cousins get justice?
Not in either case, no. Samuel was murdered in 1970. He was the first RUC officer to be murdered by the Provisional IRA in the Troubles, along with his colleague, Constable Roy Miller, at Cross Maglen in South Armagh. No one has ever been brought to justice for their murder. And Alec was killed along with nine other RUC officers in a mortar attack on Uri Police Station in 1985. No one has ever been brought to justice for their murder.
So what is justice for you then? Is it prosecutions and convictions?
It is, because that is the traditional form of justice. It is about making people amenable for the crimes that they have committed. I've listened very carefully, and I want to say to both of the previous speakers that every single person who lost their life in the Troubles, whether they were a civilian, a soldier, a police officer, a solicitor, a prison officer, every single life lost is a tragedy. It's a tragedy for the families, and it's a tragedy for the community in which those people lived. And I think we need to bend every effort to ensure that Northern Ireland does not get dragged back to those dark days again. I would also have to say, for some balance in this discussion, that, and inevitably, given the cases that you've just been discussing, a lot of the focus has been on what loyalists did and what the state did. But for the record, there were 1,696 murders committed by the Provisional IRA. The Provisional IRA killed more Catholics than either the UVF or the UDA, and that's not something anyone should be proud of. I'm just simply making a statement of fact that when we talk about sectarianism, it's a bit more complex than that. The Troubles were about so much more than Protestants killing Catholics and vice versa. And I think we need to acknowledge that complexity, because if we are simplistic in our approach, then we fail to understand the complexity of the solutions that we need to find to deal with our troubled past. And that really is the priority now. I don't know if families will get justice in many cases. I don't think they should be denied the right to pursue justice, which is why we oppose the concept of an amnesty. We need to find some system that creates balance and proportionality and enables every victim and every family of a victim to pursue justice in the way that they feel is appropriate. And what we cannot have, if we are to be fair and if we're to deal with this in a proper and balanced way, is a hierarchy of victimhood. And I would say to the Finucan family, and I have met the family, and I understand the concerns that they have, but when we hear talk of inquiries, there are 3,000 unsolved murders. And the families of, for example, the King's Mill massacre, 10 innocent Protestants lined up against the side of a road and murdered in cold blood on a cold night on a country road, those people are entitled to the truth and justice as the Finucan family. Every single one of those families, their pain is no different. Their sense of loss is no different. And yet they look at the current situation and they feel that they are not getting a level playing field, that they are not being given the same priority as others, that they're not given the same airtime, their voice is not heard in the same way. And therefore, I think we need to find a process that treats every victim in the same way, gives every family the same right, and we don't want to go down a road where we pick out and choose single cases here and there and just abandon the rest of them.
But by the extension, though, Geoffrey,
that would be a greater injustice than the one we've already suffered.
But do you support their right to call for a campaign for a public inquiry?
Everyone has the right to campaign for whatever they feel is appropriate. But I'm saying, as someone who has to deal with, as a politician, the whole issue around how we deal with our the legacy of our troubled past, that the solution is not to be found in singling out special cases for special attention. The solution is to be found in treating everybody the same. You know, I hear a lot about equality in Northern Ireland, and yet I see people pressing very hard for a preference, for preferential treatment, for special treatment, for special funding, for special legal means of investigating the loss of their loved one. And I'm simply saying, on behalf of the thousands of families who have not been accorded any of that priority, that they too are entitled to the same treatment.
Michael Finucane, is that what you're doing, looking for special treatment?
My family started asking questions after my father was murdered because we regarded the circumstances of his murder as suspicious from the outset. And not just suspicious in the sense that he was obviously unlawfully killed by paramilitaries, but that we believed he had been threatened by RUC officers, that reports of threats from clients that he represented, threatening his safety, threatening his life, making disparaging comments about his work and his apparent political persuasions or allegiances, all were designed to denigrate him. And then he's killed by loyalist paramilitaries who claim he was an IRA man. And the suspicion that abounded immediately was whether the antagonism he faced from RUC officers had spilled over into action, and although we didn't have a name for it in 1989, whether it constituted collusion. Now, 25 years on, 25 years of hard graft, trying to get through the obstacles, the obfuscation, the lies, the deceit, the misinformation, much of it emanating from the state, we now find we find that he was his murder could have been prevented, should have been prevented. The people responsible for it should have been apprehended immediately, and that the state was very much in control and behind it all. And you know, not everybody has the energy, the resources, the means, the ability, or the desire to pursue a 25-year campaign to find yourself at the point that the Finucane family finds itself at. We have found ourselves becoming, if you like, a kind of an example case for what might be applied as a template to many other circumstances. In that respect, I mean, you know, Geoffrey has a point, but you know, certain cases raise a greater level of disquiet because of apparent state involvement or state action. And I mean, you know, Geoffrey campaigned for or helped campaign for an inquiry into the murder of Billy Wright in the Mays prison, and rightly so. That case raised questions and was extremely serious and sensitive. That's not to say that anyone else deserves less, but surely we are able to look at things in the context of promoting the rule of law, law and order, and the way things ought to be, and say we should do something about this particular case, we should look into it, we should devote time and resources to it. Because at the time many people were killed in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, time and resources and effort were not devoted to these cases. And they were very often explained away in the context of conflict. Oh no, it's not possible to look at this and it's not possible to examine that. When in fact it was extremely possible. Or the truth behind the killing was known all along, and the wringing of hands by the authorities and the you know, the apologies and the, you know, the regretful expressions that were presented to families were nothing less than a charade designed to cover up what was really happening behind the scenes.
Okay, Alec Maskey, you're in the BBC studio there in Belfast as well. You're very welcome to the programme. What is your understanding of justice? If there is to be true peace, don't people who have lost loved ones deserve justice, and people have to be honest if there is to be justice?
Well, Audrey, I think in fairness to the format of the programme, for the benefit of your listeners, I am also would be described as a victim. I mean, my home was attacked on 5 occasions with petrol bombs and pipe bombs. I was seriously injured in 1987. Thankfully, I survived that gun attack. In 1993, on the 1st of May, the worst of all attack led to the death of a friend of mine, Mr. Alan Lundy, a husband and a father of 5 children, shot dead with an AK-47, which was imported into the north by loyalists in collusion with British personnel. None of those weapons have ever been recovered or decommissioned. So I think, for the benefit of your listeners, I mean, I have a personal inside interest in all this, since I would be described as a victim, indeed, thankfully, a survivor. But as I said, the worst incident involved the killing of a friend of mine whose family have never received any justice in regard to his killing. So I think it's important for your listeners to hear the full story. But I have to set all of that to one side. I can't speak for the Lundy family. I wouldn't dare to do that. They would obviously have to speak for themselves, whatever their wishes might be. But I have to set aside the number of attacks that were led on against myself, including my near death, simply because I was a Republican representative. I know that in one case, a British Army spy, Brian Nelson, was sentenced for conspiring to kill me and a number of other people. He was exonerated in the court by a British Army colonel who came to give him a personal character reference. Mr. Nelson served a very short period of time in prison because he had a deal from the then British Attorney General, Patrick Mayhew, a member of Maggie Thatcher's cabinet. So, like Pat Finucane's case and a number of others, my case would go right, in my view, to the British cabinet table. But I have to set all of that aside, and I'm only too glad to set all that to one side, because as a political representative, I have a responsibility and an obligation to try to find a solution which resolves most people, at least gives people the horrible word closure in some way or other, which is why my party and I joined Jeffrey in the talks with Richard Haass and Megan O'Sullivan. We were in those talks. My party and I personally signed up to the Haass proposal. Jeffrey's hasn't. So I have an obligation, notwithstanding the circumstance that I found myself in and what my family went through over many, many years. I have to rise above all of that and try to find a solution, a political solution, which allows people to have an opportunity to try to access justice, or at least the truth, because there's no one of us, not even one political party, no representative, can faithfully represent all of the wishes of the victims.
But is there a willingness on the part of people in Northern Ireland to be truthful, to be honest, to have that capability of coming to a forum of whatever description and admitting what they have done and why they have done it?
Well, certainly from a Republican point of view, I mean, we have made it very clear on behalf of Sinn Féin that we would be very fervently arguing for Republicans to come forward into a process. And that's why I think for us, the Haass proposals at least represented a good opportunity. It would not resolve everyone's grief. It would not resolve everyone's to everyone's satisfaction the problem. But at least from our point of view, it give an opportunity to help allow more people than currently are getting any satisfaction at all in regard to the either a form of justice or the truth, whatever those families would opt for. So, I mean, I do believe that people would come forward. I don't think for one second it would be easy. I do believe it would be much easier to get that level playing field if we have some type of an external commission set up, because what's very clear, Republicans won't be trusted by others, the British government will not be trusted by others, unionism will not be trusted by others. So let's understand that if we get an external-led, credible process, then I do think you would maximise the chances for people to come forward and to give everyone at least some possibility of getting the truth or justice, whichever option they would seek to, you know,
okay,
secure.
Okay, quick
for
word
themselves.
From you on that, Jeffrey, just before we take a break.
Yes, I mean, I think we do need to find a way forward on how we deal with the past, and the events of the past few days have again proven the need for this. I think that having met victims, and I'm, you know, from right across the community, from both sides and none, there is a sense that a process must have an avenue that leads, or at least gives the opportunity to pursue justice, and at the same time, people also have the opportunity to pursue the truth, and that we design a framework within which families can approach this and have the support that they need. So I think that clearly we're in an election period now, but between the election and the summer, we've got to redouble our efforts to try and reach agreement.
But this
on
has been going on, Jeffrey, for so long, and it's a point to all the political representatives in the North. And Hugh Orde was on with Stephen Nolan on Radio Ulster this morning. We might hear from him after the break. But one of the points he was making during that interview was he did not believe that the political will existed in Northern Ireland to deal with the past.
I think he's wrong. I think the political will does exist. It is a matter of finding an agreement on what is a very, very difficult... I mean, you've heard four viewpoints tonight, and I'm sure your viewers will have recognised that these are very, very emotive issues. For many, they are painful. And so it's not a matter of a quick fix. Yes, it has taken us time. We haven't yet been able to secure agreement. But, you know, when in the context of over 30 years of conflict and division and massive loss of life, I think that it was always going to be difficult, and this was probably going to be the greatest challenge of the peace process. But I know from all the parties involved that there is a will to try and find a way forward. There's a desire to find a way forward, and the events of the last few weeks again underline that need. But it isn't easy. There are so many different opinions out there. Drawing them all together and finding a consensus is a major challenge.
OK, we'll continue this discussion after the break.
RTE Radio 1.
You're welcome back to Late Debate. We're debating tonight if Northern Ireland can achieve both peace and justice. And we're joined in studio here in Dublin by Michael Finucane from our Belfast studio. We're joined by Jude White, whose mother, Peggy White, was murdered in a UVF bomb attack in 1984. We're also joined from there by Sinn Féin's Alec Maskey and from London by DUP MP Geoffrey Donaldson. Jude White, I've come back to you. You've heard everyone else's perspective here. You said to us earlier on that you believe people should forgive and move on. Is that it? No forum, no Truth and Reconciliation Commission, no facility where people can sit down and admit past crimes and explain?
In short, yes, because it's a decision I've come to after 4 years. I've been sitting on a victims and survivors forum for 4 years. That's four full years, maybe 250 meetings. We have met everybody from Mullinhead to Mizzenhead and from Ballycastle to West Cork. We have talked to everybody. We have taken advice from everybody. And we can't agree on the time of day when it comes to dealing with the past. There are four organisations up here working night and day dealing with the past. They're getting nowhere. And most importantly, the evidence is there for people to simply analyse. We have had two very major reports. One was Eames Bradley, which Hugh Orr this morning said it might be a good idea to dust off. This took 2.5 years to put together by 12 people who were paid. They weren't volunteers like the Victims Forum. They were paid to do this. And they produced a very, very comprehensive report, which was destroyed by one or two small, very, very vocal victims groups. And it was destroyed over one simple thing, over a £12,000 acknowledgement payment for people who had died in this conflict. And the precedent for that payment came indeed from the Republic of Ireland, from the Irish government, who made that payment in light of the Dublin and Monaghan bombings. This was a very comprehensive report put in the bin for no reason whatsoever. We followed this on from Haas, and we had seven drafts of Haas, and we were 90% of the way, we were told, by the leader of the official Unionist Party, and it was binned. The truth of the matter is you cannot blame politicians and you cannot blame the Victims Forum. The bottom line is the will isn't there. If the political will was here, I could leave this studio now and go to a filing cabinet in the police headquarters and bring you back the names of the four people who were involved in the murder of that fine man, Patrick Finucane. And I'm sure I could bring you back the names of the four special branch officers who ran those four double agents. The truth is the will is not here because people have two narratives. We don't agree on what the past was. We can barely agree on what the present is, never mind what the past is. So the evidence that I see is that there is, in fact, and this is a purely pragmatic decision, there is this problem of the past cannot be resolved. And it's best left now, in my view, or in the words of a journalist in the Sunday Times, it's best left to a future generation who really won't care enough about it to try and deal with it. It's intractable. It poisons the body politic. It creates a dysfunctional society that is at war with itself. We live up here in two parallel universes. We eat apart, we live apart, we're educated apart, we go in different places for our holidays, we adhere to different sporting codes, and we have different allegiances to different flags. And then in the context of that, politicians have had their go. They've had two goals, in fact. They had Eames Bradley and they had the Haas proposals, and Haas failed simply because of intransigence, overwhelmingly, from the Unionist side.
Alec Maskey, what do you say to that? That it is simply too intractable, it cannot be sorted out?
Well, I mean, I am an optimist, and I have to obviously respect Jude. I know Jude a long time, and I've listened to him very, very carefully over the last number of years, because I know his work. Obviously, he's a direct interest in all this since he lost his mother, very sadly. He's been working with the Victims Forum for a number of years. He's commented on this and thought thoroughly about it over many, many years, and he rarely says anything just off the top of his head. So I have to respect what he's actually advocating. I'm not so sure that, you know, a wider number of people at this moment in time might want that. What I have to do, and what my party did in the Haas talks, was to say, well, at least here's something which might afford the maximum number of victims' families some type of redress, be it in the form of a judicial hearing or someone going to court or getting at least the truth, because it's about trying to maximise the taking away the pain from people as far as you possibly can do. So I wouldn't for one second guess what you're advocating. I do know that there are others who would maybe argue for something else, which is why we believe the Haas proposals represented the best way forward. And I don't think it's right to characterise that there's no political will as such, because, I mean, there was political will. There may not be enough. I mean, certainly there's enough. There were parties, including the Taoiseach in this one, who thought that the Haas proposals were representing the way forward. And we must remember, Jude himself referred to the Dublin Monaghan bombings. A lot of people in the south of the country, also in the 26 counties, lost people in this conflict. I mean, we had the Dublin Monaghan bombings themselves, 1974, the largest death toll of the conflict, 33 people, 300 maybe wounded on the same day. And they're not going to get the truth by the look of it, because despite every Taoiseach in the last number of years, all of the Taoiseach who have raised this drag of the British government continue to refuse to give the Irish government the truth. So what chance does Jude White or Michael Finucane or a whole lot of other people to get the truth from a government whenever one sovereign government is denying, in this case an Irish sovereign government, the truth of what happened to their citizens? So it is an
uphill. Of course, Alec Maskey, I mean, many people will say to you that many Republicans too are very, very reluctant to admit their past.
Well, I'm not doubting that at all, and there's no immunity. There's no statute of limitations here, so there's no one would have immunity. If someone wants to come forward and take responsibility for something, then they'll do that, and good luck. But I mean, they're not going to walk away from that.
But I mean, if people now aren't even willing to admit, I mean, Jude mentioned David Irvine earlier on, and he was a man who was always willing and upfront to admit his past. Why can't others do the same?
He served a sentence for bombing bars, actually, and I knew and worked with David Irvine quite a lot right through the ceasefires, right through the talks leading to the Good Friday Agreement and well beyond. So he's a man I certainly respect it. David Irvine's one of those interesting characters. He said an awful lot from time to time.
But the point is, how can anyone expect honesty from any future process when people simply cannot admit what they've done in the past?
Well, I'm not really sure what you're referring to there. I think you have a hidden question there, and maybe you should spit it out, Audrey, with all due respect. But as far as I'm concerned, from Republican point of view, I do believe that Republicans would come forward, but we're going to have a process. At this moment in time, I don't know the truth of what happened at my home. I do believe I know what happened at my home and reason why people were targeting me and people like me, which resulted in the death, in my case, of a friend, Alan Lundy, as I mentioned earlier on. And I do believe that that went straight to the British cabinet table. I would like to know who was pulling the strings. I've actually spoke to loyalists directly who I knew were involved in targeting me personally. And I've actually asked them, did they ever reflect on who was pulling their strings? Because people more powerful than them were actually responsible. So I would like a process which actually airs that. More importantly for me, in the long term, is to make sure that those types of things never happen again. And let's be very clear, I don't only mean here, I have an international perspective, because some of the people who were involved in organising the collusion were also doing likewise in Iraq and other countries around the world. So I want the truth laid bare across the board here, not just from a British or a state, but also from a Republican point of view. And anyone else who was involved in the conflict, I would like to see the truth put on the table so as it is prevented from happening either here or anywhere else again. Because for me, the priority has to be that we make sure that there are no further victims in this conflict.
Michael Finucane, what is your opinion as to the best way forward? I know what you've said specific to your own father's case, but in a broader sense, it just sounds like all whataboutery. You know, one side and the other side, and there's not much honesty, and you cannot imagine it ever working out.
The great plague of whataboutery is a difficult one to get away from. I think you have to start by sort of realizing that, you know, if you're going to describe the conflict in terms of two sides within Northern Ireland, a conflict between Republican and Loyalist, then you have to include also the external dimension, and that's Britain. I don't think Britain has ever really stopped either thinking of itself as being at war with republicanism or wanting to beat republicanism. I think that's evident in their actions to try and limit and stymie inquiries into actions by their own forces and also actions by in the internal security forces, be it the RUC or the UDR or whoever. But I also think that the general attitude and the rhetoric that's forthcoming from the British establishment in terms of how it views republicanism, how it views Ireland, how it continues to view republicanism, and the way in which punitive measures against individuals are still being pursued in the form of criminal prosecutions. The recent cases, the arrest of Gerry Adams being the most high profile, have almost all been against former Republican volunteers, operatives, or former paramilitaries. To the best of my knowledge, there have been a small number of Loyalist paramilitary arrests, although I don't think any old cases have come forward for prosecution as yet. But there have been no arrests of former police. There have been no arrests of former soldiers. So the public perception, and certainly the very strong perception, I think, within the Republican and Nationalist community, is that the one-sided justice game goes on. And that was something that was poison within the north of Ireland throughout the 1970s, 1980s, and right up into the early 1990s. It wasn't just about paramilitarism. It wasn't just about a military campaign being fought out in many different areas of Ireland between British forces and Republican guerrilla forces, with Loyalists coming into it, you know, wherever and whenever they did. There was another aspect to it. And in many cases, and this is using an international, if you like, legal template as the benchmark, there was a perversion of the rule of law and normal democratic processes, normal processes of justice and due process, and things that people fought to establish in other countries were just changed and manipulated in order to suit the interests of Britain. And they were nothing to do very often with apprehending people for offences or actions that they had taken. Very often it was in order to preserve the British establishment reputation, persona, facade, in order to deflect criticism from the way it was essentially running its colony in Northern Ireland. And that mindset persists to this day. I was struck recently, the anniversary of the murder of Éirí Níomh was being highlighted in certain news media, and people were talking about Neve's influence on British policy right at the early stages of Margaret Thatcher's premiership. And his mindset was very much a defeat of Republican paramilitaries agenda at all costs, sacrifice nothing, compromise nothing. And a commentator was reviewing his legacy and talking about how much he was missed and how much this mindset would be of so such a great use to us now as we try to move on into peace. And I thought, what an utter confusion and total lack of understanding of someone looking at the conflict period in Northern Ireland. And I really don't think it matters whether you describe yourself as being of unionist persuasion or Republican persuasion or any of the other variations that we know about. The extent to which Britain, I think, plays its own game when it comes to Ireland cannot be underestimated. And I think one of the great problems about trying to resolve the post-conflict issues and the legacies of the past is that whatever about the willingness of politicians within the North to get together and try to solve what is essentially our problem, I think Britain's motivation always has to be doubted. And ultimately, I don't think they really care if you're a unionist or a Republican.
Do you agree with any of that, Geoffrey?
No, I don't. I think Michael has a mindset that hasn't changed either, with all due respect to him. When I hear someone bright, intelligent and young like Michael describing Northern Ireland as a colony, frankly, I despair. I really, really despair of any hope of reconciliation when we have language like that. I mean, I don't recognise that at all. My family have lived in Northern Ireland for over 300 years. We're not colonialists. I'm a British citizen. I was born a British citizen. I wasn't planted anywhere. I was born in a hospital on the island of Ireland, in a county in the island of Ireland. My family have lived on the island of Ireland for centuries, and I'm British. I'm not a colonialist. I'm not a planter. I'm a citizen. And the people I represent have rights as well. And, you know, I hear Michael talk a lot about the state, almost to the point where he obsesses about it. But I hear nothing from Michael. Nothing by way of recognition of all of those people, almost 1,700 of them, 1,696 to be precise, who were murdered by the Provisional IRA. Nothing. No mention of, you know, the RUC were responsible for 56 killings in Northern Ireland. There were many, many more times that RUC officers who were murdered in cold blood, and yet no recognition of all of that. And, you know, when we have this one-sided narrative, and I try to be open-minded, I recognise there is suffering on all sides, and I recognise that in any solution we have to, we've got to take an holistic approach. But when I listen, as I have done tonight, to this constant focus on the British state, on what the British state has done, on the conspiracy theories that are associated with the British state, I wonder if the Queen ever visited Dublin. I wonder if President Hickens ever visited Great Britain. I wonder if there's any process of reconciliation. I wonder if the language will ever change. I wonder if the mindsets will ever be altered. You know, it saddens me that this is the language that's being used. And if we're ever to create this new place that we want to create, and reconciliation in Northern Ireland, on the island of Ireland, and between Great Britain and Ireland, then, you know, it's more than the British state that needs to change its mindset. I think there are people on all sides who need to broaden their horizons, who need to recognise that their choice of language at times is inappropriate, is offensive, and is unbalanced. It does not recognise the suffering on both sides. It is obsessed and focused with a number of killings associated with the state, almost to the exclusion of anything else that happened in Northern Ireland over the last 40 years. And that's no way to solve the problem. It is absolutely, we're going to go nowhere if we adopt that approach. If I were to adopt the approach that the only murders I'm interested in were those committed by the IRA, I would get nowhere with that argument. I would get absolutely nowhere. I'm interested in all the killings. I'm interested in what happened and that all families have the opportunity to pursue truth and justice. But we're not going to get there ever. And we're not going to get agreement if the starting point is that the focus is on the British state. And, you know, that's just not going to work.
Quick response.
Proportionately,
to that,
it's just so out of kilter, it's not a solution.
Okay.
Geoffrey, I think you and I could sit down and work out the way forward, you know, for the place where we grew up. I don't live in Belfast anymore. I live in Dublin, but I think you and I could sit down and work out our problems and our different, come to an understanding of why we are different and also what we have in common. But my experience of dealing with Britain and its establishment, and of being delayed and lied to and misinformed deliberately about things that subsequently were proven to be true on the basis of written down records in British files, in British warehouses, makes me very, very dubious that state will ever really treat us fairly. And okay. I don't think in that regard you or I are any different. I think they're quite prepared to be unfair to both of us.
Okay, final word to you, Jude White in Belfast. There's been a peace in Northern Ireland now since 1998 or so. Can it be a true lasting peace without justice?
Well, I mean, the first thing is blessed are the peacemakers, and if my point needed verification, surely it's in the comments from Geoffrey and Michael. I don't believe Geoffrey and Michael could sit down and plot the way from Dublin to Bray, frankly. And this is the problem that we have. We have two narratives, two very intelligent, well-meaning fellows there who agree on precisely nothing. Okay. And that's simply my point. I did believe that a truth commission might be a prerequisite to this, but I'm abandoning all hope of that. At least there's nobody dying. That's the main thing.
Jude, thank you very much indeed. Thanks to Alec Maskey, Geoffrey Donaldson and Michael Finucane. Back at 10 tomorrow night. Till then, good night. The Late Debate with Audrey Carville was produced tonight by Donal O'Herlihy. The broadcast coordinator was Maeve Mooney. The researcher is Richie Byrne. And sound supervision tonight was by Dave Gibson.